رحم الله من قرأ سورة الفاتحة. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون. الذي بعدا فلا يرى وقربا فشهد النجوى تبارك وتعالى. والصلاة والسلام على سيد الأنبياء وخاتم المرسلين وشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا بالقاسم محمد. ولأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين الذين أذهب الله عنهم الرجس وطهرهم تطهيرا. واللائنة الدائمة الباقية لأعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم وغاصب حقوقهم من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقال الله سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه الكريم: إن الدين عند الله الإسلام. صلوات الله وسلامه. I've been beginning the majalis for this ashura with the ayat from Surah Al Imran, ayat number 19. قال الله سبحانه وتعالى says: إن الدين عند الله الإسلام. Verily the religion acceptable in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the religion of Islam. This is the final message which was sent to the Prophet of Islam. And this was the last sharia and the last deen, which is to stay in force till the day of Qiyamah. And that is the theme of my discussion when I talk about Islam and modernity. That how can this religion which started 1400 years ago be relevant to us in this part of the world at this stage of human history? The answer that we have been providing is basically the issue of understanding the process of continuity and change in Islam. We began with the concept of Hijra, then we moved on to the concept of how the change in continuity takes place in the various cultures around the world. The most obvious example was the example of hijab, where you have a constant value manifesting in different forms in different parts of the Muslim world. We also looked at the issue of modernity itself and the three main problems as far as the modern Western culture is concerned, which is to do with the issue of rebellion against the traditions of the forefathers and the issue of this implications of sexual revolution in the society, and also this overemphasis in indulgence of the body and its pleasures. Last night we looked at the positive element of the Western culture at the moment, and that was the issue of knowledge. And there also I tried to identify elements of continuity as well as the elements of change. Seeking of knowledge is a constant value in Islam that will never change. The methods of seeking knowledge depends on zaman and makan, and that would constantly change from one time to another and one place to another. Tonight I would like to go to another example, more on the positive side of what we have here, and that is actually by raising this whole issue of Muslim participation in the political process of the Western countries. And I would like to show you again, even that in that example, elements of continuity and elements of change. Because the question now is becoming an important question for us. The community now, the Muslims in North America and Europe, have already settled down. They have basically found their roots now. Their next generation doesn't know a weapon other than their own countries, wherever they are, in Europe or North America. And so this becomes a fiqh issue. Are Muslims allowed to participate in the political process of a non-Muslim government? Remember, Islam is not only, you know, whether this sandwich is halal or haram or not. You know, can we wear this and that? It is a complete way of life. So even this issue, which now is becoming an issue for the community on a collective basis, the Muslims in the West, becomes a fiqh issue. Whether it is permissible for us to participate in this political process or not. And this is where you will see again this element of continuity and the elements of change will come forward. And we have to educate ourselves individually as well as the community to know what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, what are the limits that we can go forward in this process. Salawat alayhi wa sallam. Let me begin by talking about different times, different rules. If we have access to a masoom imam, our answer would be very different. And we are assuming a situation where the masoom imam is accessible to us, but he is not the ruler himself. If Ali alayhi salam's time was there and we were there, there is no question. He is our leader, he is our ruler, we are part of that system. But we are talking about a situation of the imams who came later on, where she is allowed to participate or take over a position in the government of those who are opposed to the Ahlul Bayt. During the days of the imams, when imams were accessible to us, this whole issue entirely depended on the specific permission of the masoom of the time. So it's not a fatwa anybody can give. In every specific situation, an individual had to refer to the masoom imam and seek their guidance. Are they allowing or not? If you look at the ahadith of our imams during the Banu Abbasid time, this is where we see the Shias now have grown as far as numbers are concerned, and they are now members of the overall Muslim society. So these questions became more, you know, prevailing during the days of Banu Abbas, not during the days of Banu Umayyah. Banu Umayyah time, the Shias were still surviving for their existence. And so when you look at the time of Banu Umayyah, you will see there are so many sayings from our imams, very strongly warning the Shias not to even accept a clerical position in the government of those who are unjust rulers. Even as a, you know, clerks there. You know, if we have time, I'll give you one very interesting example, but later on. But on the other hand, at the same time of Banu Abbasid time, where our imams were accessible to the Shias, there are some companions of the imam, some of them very well known, people like Ali bin Yaqtin and others, who actually accepted positions in the government of Banu Abbas, even to the level of ministers. And in all those cases, you will see that they did it only after getting specific permission from the imam of the time. But now we are not in that time. I just wanted you to know that, you know, the rulings would change according to the time and the circumstances. Now we don't have, you know, access to the masoom imam. We don't have a masoom ruler. We are living in the time of ghaibat. What is to be done? What would be the judgment of the Sharia? Fortunately, when it comes to our Shia Mujtahideen, from day one of Ghaibat al-Kubra, this was an issue. How do we handle this situation? Are we allowed to get involved in the government or not? And you will see, for example, they discussed this whole issue under two themes in the fiqh jurisprudence works. One is known as Hurmat al-Ma'unat al-Zalimeen, the prohibition of helping the unjust rulers. That was one theme of discussion. Other was حُرْمَةُ الْوِلَايَ مِنْ قَبَلِ الْجَائِرِ, the prohibition of accepting a position from an unjust ruler. So there were two things. One was cooperating with them and helping them. Other was accepting a position in their government. And under that, the first extensive work was written by Sayyid Murtaza. Sayyid Murtaza, the brother of Sayyid Razi, who compiled Nahjul Balagha. And these are very close to the early days of Ghaybat-e-Kubra. And he lived in Baghdad. And this is the time when some of the Shias were ministers, and they were actually in position more powerful than the position of the Khalifa. You know, sometimes the Khulafa became puppets of the ministers. And one of the situations was during the time of Sheikh Saduq, Sheikh Mufid, and others, where Ali Buya family came to power as ministers, and they basically were the main rulers of the time. And this is where Sayyid Murtaza wrote this extensive treatise on this issue. Later on, Sheikh Tusi, who founded the Hawza of Najaf 1,000 years ago, he is the one who expanded on this issue. And if you look at the mujtahideen of our time, they also discuss this issue under the same concept of prohibition of working with the unjust rulers. Where is it allowed? Where is it not allowed? Salawat alayka wa rahmatullah. The main issue for the Shia mujtahideen is the issue of, in the ghaybat time, iqamatul adl, which means promoting justice. And they will ask you, if you go to your marja and ask, should I get involved in a non-Muslim government or not? Or to what level should I get involved? They will give you a constant criteria of where it is allowed and where it is not allowed. The answer would be, if justice and people's welfare can be maintained by cooperating and working with a non-Muslim government, then it is permissible to do that. They use the term al-qiyam bi masalih al-ibad. Means if you are able to maintain the justice and welfare of the people by getting involved, then it is permissible. But if you are not able to do that, you are just getting in because, oh, I'll get a good position, shar'an, it becomes haram. And so the criteria would be iqamatul adl. Whether by getting involved in the process you are able to promote justice in society, then it will be permissible to work with a non-Muslim government. And if you are not able to do that, then that will not be allowed. Maybe, you know, even if you look at the earlier ulama, you will see people like Sheikh Saduq. They cooperated with rulers like Sa'id bin Ubad. Sheikh Mufid cooperated with the Ali Buya rulers, Sayyid Murtaza, Sayyid Razi, and many, many examples where we see that our senior ulama, when they saw that it is possible to guide this fellow in a way that justice can be maintained in the society for the masalih of the ibad, welfare of the people, then they would cooperate and work with those rulers also. Salawat alayhi wa sallam. Coming to our own time, I'm just giving you this history so you know that, you know, we're not just, you know, pulling out masail from vacuum. No. You know, our jurisprudence and our history is very rich. Unfortunately, we don't know about it. It's new contemporary issues, but we have examples in the past. And in our sources itself, Ijtihad is a living institution among the Shias. When we look at our own hijrah to the western part of the world, we have to now accept that there is no issue of going back. In a way, we have now burned the bridges as far as going back is concerned. Visiting is okay. But nobody is thinking going back. Even if you are thinking, your children are not thinking about it. This is the only home they know. And Islam, as I said earlier, even if you remember that couplet from Allama Iqbal, you know the whole world is our watan. We don't have a specific watan. Even according to Shari'i rulings, if you see, when you go for traveling, if you stay somewhere for less than 10 days, you get the concession. 4 rakat namaz becomes 2. Not that a namaz becomes half, then you do fajr only 1 rakat. No, 4 rakat becomes 2. But what happens if you're going to stay more than 10 days? If you are going to stay more than 10 days, you are no more considered to be musafir. If you are no more a musafir and a traveler, what are you now? From the Shari'i perspective, you are a resident now. And so, we also have this concept of ta'addudul awtan. A person can have more than one watan. So you can be, maybe you have still a house or a family, you know, where you frequently visit, let's say in Dar es Salaam, and you have a house here. You have watans, not one, two. And so as far as we are concerned, this is basically our watan now. There is no issue of going back. And so what do we do here? We only come here for higher education and business opportunities, making money and paying tax here. That's the end of the process as far as our participation in this society is concerned. Are we allowed to do, you know, get involved in the political process or not? Again, the same criteria. If you see that the system is fundamentally based on justice and fairness for all, and by you getting involved, even though it's a non-Muslim government, that will be permissible. We have the example of Muhaqqiq Tusi, when the Mongolians invaded Middle East, and they totally destroyed Baghdad, and that was the end of the Abbasid Khilafat. Muhaqqiq Tusi actually worked with Halaku Khan. Not because he considered him to be a just ruler, but he realized he had something that this fellow needed. Because these Mongolians believed in astronomy quite a lot, and he knew about it quite a lot. He used that to influence them in order to lessen their zulm. So one is the issue of, you know, promoting justice, one is even to reduce the level of tyranny and injustice that these people were doing. And so we see the example in our history, and when we look at the western part of the world, till about 200 years ago, the perspective of Muslim ulama was that the world is a bipolar view, divided into two parts, Darul Islam, Darul Kufr, the abode of Muslims and the abode of Kafirs. But now we live in a situation in the 21st century where we are changing the perspective of the dunya. And we call it now multipolar view. It's not Darul Islam and Darul Kufr. Yes, we have Darul Islam where they are Muslim countries. But then when we look at the non-Muslims, we have two categories. Either it's Darul Sulh, they are non-Muslim countries and governments who have signed treaties with Muslim countries, sometimes directly, sometimes even by being members of the UNO. Or there are countries that don't have any specific treaty with Muslim countries, but they are known as Darul Mu'ahid, means they are neutral to Muslims. They are not enemies of Islam. And in that situation, you know, our perspective and the opinion in fiqh would change. When we look at our own situation in the western part of the world, when we compare many of the Muslim countries, especially in the Middle East, we see three things which are positive elements of the society in the West, which is not there. Number one, freedom of practicing our religion. Number two, the issue of basic rights, respect for it. And number three, regard for the law for all citizens. You just look at the freedom of practice. You go to Saudi Arabia, you think you can do majlis easily the way you're doing it here in New York? Even in UAE, from last year there have been restrictions. By 10, everything should come to the close. You know, and so we have here what is known as freedom of practicing our religion. And when we look at these elements, this society and the system allows the citizens to participate. Not only in, you know, contributing economically to this society, but even in the political process. The system does not bar you from participation. We might have problems. We might have some concerns. We might not have the know-how. We might not have the confidence to do that. Maybe we do not even think about it from a religious point of view, whether it's allowed or not. And if it's allowed, what are the limitations? So whatever is stopping us is not the system. They are restrictions that we have put on ourselves. And this is where I think we have to really, you know, think about it. This is a society where decisions are made by elected bodies. There is no kingship here. And they are people, the representatives are elected through the election process. So this is where we realize that, you know, we can be part of that. And I'll just give you some examples of, you know, we have two situations only. Either we sit down and don't do anything, and then when the decisions are made affecting us adversely, we complain. Or the other choice is that gradually get involved. Let your voice be heard. We might not succeed initially. We might not succeed all the time. But at least at the end of the day, we would be able to say we tried. Or our voice was there, it was maybe not a, you know, listened to, but we were able to say our, you know, point of view. And the choice would be not to be, you know, on the sideline and only complain, rather get involved. Look at the school boards here. I'm sure the system here would be the same as Canada. You know, it is by representation. Decisions are made. Get involved as Muslim groups with the school boards. Because school policies basically affect our own children. You know, when it comes to the issue of curriculum, dress code, hijab issues, outdoor physical activities, especially during the month of Ramadan, special religious holidays, if we don't have our own people on the board speaking for us, then each Muslim family would have to struggle with their own individual child and the problems. But we will be able to deal with these issues on a systematic manner if we have our own people voicing the concerns of the community. Salawat alayka Allah. Yes, we run up behind other, you know, elected leaders we have now. Any problem, we go to them. But I remember more than 10 years ago in Montreal, there was a gathering of the Shia organizations, and one of the Canadian senators had come, who is a pro-Palestinian, pro-Arab senator from the French background. And in that gathering, he said something which I can never forget. He said, "Till when do you want me to represent you in the legislation? When will you have your own people speaking for yourselves?" Because the system doesn't stop you from that. And so the issue is that, you know, there is this, you know, possibilities there. The laws do not forbid that. And so we have to, you know, especially the next generation, you have to think about it, especially from the religious point of view, educate yourself, even from the religious perspective, that what would be allowed and what would not be allowed. Salawat alaykum. There is a difference in the countries that we have come from, whether it's East Africa or India or Pakistan or Iraq, you know, wherever you come from. In those countries, the further you are from the politicians and the police, the better you are. Huh? Because there, even the police is basically part of the political process. You know, they are basically paid by the parties. Here, things are different. I'm not saying things are okay, no. But things are different. We have challenges, we have problems. But the issue is that if we have decided that this is our homeland and this is our watan, you don't really have a choice but to train your next generation to get involved so that our rights can be preserved and the voice of the community can be heard at all levels. Salawat alaykum. But we have to ask a bigger question, and this is what I'm saying. There is a need for more education for the next generation. on this issue from the Sharia perspective. That if you go into this process of, you know, getting involved in political institutions, what should be your niyyat? People get involved in politics for a variety of reasons. They sometimes look at it career choice. Some might have this passion for social, political issues. But when you go, you have to remember that from the Shi'i perspective, you should actually go with the sense of safeguarding the rights of the community. Of course, you don't only represent the Muslims only. But you will be basically making sure that justice and fairness is there for all, especially for the minorities, and among them also especially for the Muslim minorities. There are other groups who do that. There are other minorities who do that. And why should we not do that? And this is where I would say that we also have to keep this in mind, that we should not go in with this mentality of, you know, colonial mentality that most of our immigrants are coming from there. Where bade sahib ko surur karna hota hai hamesha. You know, don't go in there as yes men. Learn the issues. Look at the policies. Whether it's domestic or foreign policies, things which adversely impact Muslim world and Muslim communities locally, you should have the courage and the knowledge and the ability to speak your mind on those issues. If you see injustice and unfair, you know, issue being decided, you should stand up. Even if you have to go against your own party, you know, view on that issue. Only then you will be able to justify the Shari'i perspective of getting involved in the political process of the Western country. Salawat. Because I hear quite a lot, yes, we appreciate and we thank these countries for having given us the opportunity to come. But you have lived here so long now. You have contributed so long. You know, the time of only feeling, you know, grateful is gone. This is the land of immigrants. Nobody can claim, other than these poor natives, that this is our land. Everybody here is all, you know, immigrant, whether 400 years ago or 50 years ago. And so we have to look at that perspective, move in with courage, with knowledge and the ability to speak what is just and fair for all. Salawat. And this is not only an Islamic perspective, it is actually a specific feature of Shia Islam. In our Usul al-Din, we talk about Tawheed. When we talk about Tawheed, we talk about Allah's existence and His qualities. We could very easily have talked about justice of God under Tawheed. But we single it out. Because in the Shia theology, justice is a very important quality for God. When we talk about the Imams and the Prophets, we talk about Isma, which guarantees that whatever they do or whatever they say is based on justice and fairness. When we talk about our Maraji, their knowledge is not sufficient. Adalat is an essential condition. Even when we talk about a simple imam jamaat, adalat is a condition there. According to one of our past alim by the name of Sayyid ibn Ta'us, he's come up with a very beautiful phrase. He says, "Al-mulku yabqa ma'al kufr, wa la yabqa ma'al zulm." He says, kingship may survive with kufr, but it cannot survive with zulm. If you have a choice between a ruler who is non-Muslim, but adil, against a ruler who is Muslim, but zalim, Shia mazhab will say you go with the kafir. Because we go with adil, don't go with zalim. That is the perspective of Shia Islam. Even the criteria of the first migration, we talked about Abyssinia. The Prophet said, go there because the king of Abyssinia is not a Muslim, he's a Christian. But he is a just ruler. And so justice is a very important issue when we look at you know, our own situation in this part of the world. Even if you look at, you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen, you will see that. Salawat alaykum. In Nahj al-Balagha, in so many different places, when he talks about government, the message is very clear from Ali that government is not an aim and objection. It's not an objective by itself. It is not the end. It is actually a means for something else. He says a government is worthwhile only if it's able to promote justice and guarantee fairness for its citizens. If the government is not able to, you know, implement justice and fairness in society, it's not worthy at all. There are three different expressions from Ali in Nahj al-Balagha, different ways he describes it. He says, a government by which I cannot enforce justice in the society is nothing more than the sneezing of a god. Have you even heard that? Look at the way Amir al-Mu'min puts it down. Sneezing of the god with all the dirt coming out and the filth. He says, you know, that government which cannot implement justice is not worth nothing. Or in one statement he says, a patched up pair of sandals is better than a government which cannot enforce justice for its people. In another occasion he says, you know, a government which cannot bring about justice in society is, you know, worse than the leaf in the mouth of a locust. This is the way Amir al-Mu'min talks about hukumat. That if a hukumat and a government cannot deliver justice, it's nothing. It's garbage. And that is why you will see that even when, you know, if you look at the events after Saqifah, Why did Amir al-Mu'mineen not resort to sword at that time? After the events of Saqifa, Abu Sufyan comes to the door of Ali. He was a, you know, major politician of the time. He comes to the door of Ali and he says, "Oh Ali, I know Khilafat is your right. And I really feel sorry for you that they have taken your right. If you allow me, I can fill the streets of Medina with horsemen to support you for your right." At least we know this much, that if Abu Sufyan knew that Ali was haq, the Khilafat was very obviously declared by the Prophet. Don't tell me things were not clear. Abu Sufyan knew about it. So others definitely knew about it. But he wanted to exploit the situation. And Ali knew his motive, that he's not really sincere, he's not my help, you know, supporter. He wants to just create fitna here, make Muslims fight, and then he will take the advantage of it. So Amir al-Mu'mineen said, "Go away, go away. I don't really care about you. I don't even believe in the sincerity of what you are saying. I don't want your help." But Abu Sufyan doesn't leave things that easily. He was even bigger shaitan. And so he now tried to incite Ali by mentioning Abu Talib's name. He says, "You know, I didn't know that the son of Abu Talib is afraid of dying. So now he's saying you are being coward. You don't want to come and fight for your right because you are afraid you will be killed." That's one of those moments in his life when he said, "Oh Abu Sufyan, go away. وَاللَّهِ ابْنَ عَبِي تَالِبْ آنِسٌ بِالْمَوْتِ مِنَ الطِّفْلِ بِالصُّدِيُ أُمِّ." "Oh Abu Sufyan, go away. I swear by Allah that this son of Abu Talib is more at ease with death than an infant is to the breast of its mother. I'm not afraid of death, but I know your motives are not sincere." And then he says, "I don't care. أَوَقَعَ الْمَوْتَ عَلَيَّ أَوَقَعَ عَلَى الْمَوْتِ." "And I don't care whether mouth comes to me, death comes to me, or I go towards the death." I'm not afraid of dying. And this is where we see this sense of justice. Basically, it was so important for Ali ibn Abi Talib that he is known as Imam al-Adl. Because if you see one of the sayings the historians have, that قُتِلَ فِي الْمِحْرَابِ لِشِدَّةِ عَدْلِهِ, Ali was killed. Why? Because he was insisting on the matter of justice and fairness for all people. Salawat alayhi wa sallam. When we talk about this issue of fairness and justice and adl, these are the values which are constant value, which will never change. A Shia will never compromise, never live with the zalimeen. And even if you look at the history, even if you look at the present circumstances, look at the Muslim world, what is happening there. A Shia will agree to be mazloom, but a Shia will never be zalim. Look at the provocation that we get in Pakistan. The provocation that we get in Afghanistan. The provocation that we get from these extremist Wahhabis in Iraq. They go to Shia masajid, Shia, you know, markets, on a Friday, at the holiest hour, these suicide bombers. But the Shias don't retaliate in that way. Why? What is restraining them? When these people even demolished the dome of the Haram in Samarra, even then the Shias did not react in that way. What restrains them? Their leaders say all the time that they are trying to provoke you, but you will not be provoked because you will not become zalim like them. They might go down to that level of brutality, become barbarians, but you will not go on that level. And this is what we have learned from the Ahlul Bayt. They would retaliate. Shias, if they have the opportunity, they will retaliate against those who do zulm. But they will never go and, you know, target innocent Sunni communities. And this is where we have to be proud. Whether it's in Lebanon, or Iraq, or Afghanistan, or Pakistan. Because we are a community which talks about adl all the time. We believe in the maraja who are adl. We believe in the imams who are adl. And that's what you see in Karbala also. This value will continue. There is no sense of generation gap that we see in the modern world. The words of Amirul Mu'minin to Abu Sufyan, that, oh Abu Sufyan, no, I'm not afraid of dying. I don't care whether death comes to me or I go towards death. The exact words from the grandfather to the grandson. There is no generation gap there. We know the story of Karbala when the caravan was moving towards Karbala. Imam Hussein was riding his horse in the front. Ali Akbar was behind. A moment came where an Imam was almost in the state of sleep and being awake. And he saw a vision of somebody saying that this caravan is moving towards death and the death is moving towards this caravan. When Imam saw that vision, he said, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." Ali Akbar heard those words. He comes forward and he says to his father that what you had said is kalimatu haqq. But what was the occasion of saying it now? And that is where Imam described this vision that he saw. See the question of the son. Ali Akbar asked only one thing. Ya abata alasna ala al-haq. Oh father, are we not on the haq? And Hussein said, yes, definitely we are on haq. That's where Ali Akbar utters the same words which Amir al-Mu'minin had uttered. He says, in this case, يَا عَبَتَا لَا نُوَالِي لَا نُبَالِي أَنَّقَعَ عَلَى الْمَوْتِ أَوْ وَقَعَ الْمَوْتَ عَلَيْنَا. We don't really care whether the death comes to us or we go towards the death. You know, with that level of ma'rifat and knowledge and akhlaq, who was even acknowledged by the enemies. You know, there is a very great tribute given to Ali Akbar from the words of Muawiyah himself. Once he was sitting with his own people and he was discussing the fight between Banu Umayyah and Banu Hashim, and he said, if there is one individual in both families on whom everybody can be united, he mentions the name of Ali Akbar bin Hussein bin Ali. When you have a son like that, with that akhlaq, with that caliber of knowledge, with that courage, on the day of Ashura, then he comes to you asking for permission to go and fight. It's amazing, on the day of Ashura, Imam's situation. Whenever even the Ashab came to him, even John, a former slave, when came to him, Imam refused. Ola Muhammad came, Imam refused. Only after much insistence he would allow them to go. Qasim came, he refused. Abbas also, he didn't allow him until the children started saying, Al-Atash, he says, go and bring water for them. But it's really, it was a moment of test and trial, personal test and trial for Hussein. That when his young son comes to him, the historian just say, Ista'azana fa'adhina lahu. Akbar asked permission to fight, and Hussein did not even hesitate for a moment. Because he knew that Allah is testing me. Qasim was not my son. Ola Muhammad were not my son. Abbas was not my son. This is my personal imtihan that Allah is taking from me. And Hussein did not hesitate. Not that he didn't love Ali Akbar. He says to Ali Akbar, go. Go and ask permission from the aunt who has raised you. Because from what we know from more credible sources, the mother of Akbar was not there. And he was raised by Bibi Zainab. According to Hamid bin Muslim, he says, I saw Ali Akbar going into the tents of Ahl al-Haram. And then I was noticing and at that tent, waiting to see him come out. But I would see that somebody is trying to come out, but he's being pulled back. And this happens again and again and again. All the Ahl al-Haram had surrounded the Akbar. They said, where are you going? Nobody is left now. I don't know how Ali Akbar was able to get the permission from the Ahl al-Haram, from Bibi Zainab and others, but then he came out, and he got on his horse, and if you really want to see what was the feeling of Hussein, Akbar realized that when he was moving towards the battlefield, he felt like somebody was following him. He stops and looks back and he saw his old father following him. That's where Akbar turns and he says, oh father, you already allowed me to go. Why are you coming behind me? That's when Hussein says, oh my son, if you had a son whom you had raised for 18 years, and then you would see him going towards his own death, then you would understand what is going in my own heart at that time. And this is one of those moments where Imam raised his hand in order to do baddua for the Yazidi forces, where he says, oh Allah, be witness, that son of mine is going towards them who was ashbahun nas, who was very similar to the Prophet, khulqan wa khalqan wa mantiqan, in his character, in his voice, and even in the semblance of his face. Whenever I wished to see my grandfather, I would look at the face of my son. And this son is now going away. Akbar goes,
And after all, he was the grandson of Ali. He was able to kill many people. Eventually, one of the champions of the Yazidi forces comes, and he was able to even defeat that fellow. Then Akbar comes back, and he comes back to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and he asks for only one thing. You can just think about it. The father saw such a good fight by the son. He has become victorious in his coming back. And what he is saying, he says, Ya Abata, سقل الحديد أجحدني والعطش قد قتلني. O my father, the weight of the armor and the weapons have made me tired, and the thirst is killing me. Is there a way I can get just a drop of water? This is the reward that Akbar is asking from his father. لیکن یہی حسین کی مظلومیت تھی, یہ ولی اللہ العظم تھے, اگر اشارہ کرتے تو نہر علقمہ اس طرح آ جاتی. لیکن حسین جانتے تھے اس اختیار کو خدا نے صرف امتحان کے لیے دیا ہے, ذاتی استعمال کے لیے نہیں ہے. حسین کچھ جواب نہ دے سکے, بس آخر میں اپنی زبان دے دیتے ہیں تاکہ بیٹے کو احساس ہو کہ بیٹا تم سے زیادہ پیاسے تو ہم ہیں. دوران حسین جناب اکبر کو امام حسین علیہ السلام روانہ کر دیتے ہیں. اس جملے کے ساتھ امام told him, O Akbar, go to the battlefield because your grandfather is already there waiting for you with a bowl of water and he will be able to quench your thirst. Azadar Hussain, when Akbar went there, اور جب برسی لگی ہے اکبر کے سیرے میں, اکبر was not able to maintain himself on the horse. He started coming down, and at that time he said something which is very unusual. All the Shuhada called Imam Hussein for help, but Akbar knew, my father is all alone, I don't want to trouble him anymore. He just said, Ya Abata, alayka minni salam, Baba, aap par aakhri salam ho. And then he said a sentence which was very lengthy, and I think about it, why did Akbar say that? He said, Oh my father, my grandfather is already here, he has already given me water, I am no more thirsty, and he is waiting for you also. And I just think in my mind, Akbar realized when he asked for a drop of water, Imam was very sad that he could not even give water to his son. And therefore the pen was there visibly on his face. Akbar, the symbol of akhlaq of Nabi, didn't want his father to feel sorrow in that way. And so he says, Oh my father, your son is no more thirsty. Azadaran Hussain, ek martaba jaise hi Akbar ki awaz aati hai, Hussain uthte hain aur Ya Ali kehke بیٹھ جاتے ہیں. دوبارہ بلند ہوئے اور پہی دائیں دیکھا, کہیں بہن دیکھا, آواز دیتے رہے, یا علی انت علی, علی تم کہاں ہو. وہاں پر ایک روایت ملتی ہے کہ جب حسین پہنچے ہیں تو جناب زینب پہلے آ چکی تھی. ادھران حسین, جناب زینب کو یہ خیال تھا یہ ضعیف باپ کا معاملہ ہے, جوان کا لاشا ہے, شاید بھائی صبر نہ کر سکے. لیکن حسین نے کہا, زینب میرا یہ ذاتی امتحان ہے, خدا را تم خیمے میں چلے جاؤ. سینے پر ہاتھ دیکھا, کہا بیٹا یہ ہاتھ کیوں رکھا ہے. جب اکبر نے ہاتھ کو اٹھایا, حسین نے نیزے کی انی کو دیکھا اور ہاتھ میں رکھنے کے بعد جب کھینچا ہے, ادداران حسین اکبر, when حسین پل آؤٹ دی سپیئر ہیڈ, ہی اٹرڈ دی ورڈز وچ حاجی اٹرز وین دے ڈو دی قربانی ان منا. حسین man was doing his qurbani in Karbala. Bismillah wa billah wa ala millat rasulillah. Us naan nazay ki ani ke saath akbar ki rooh bhi nikal aayi. Usain ne jawan ke laashe ko uthaya. Thodi dur chalne ke baad jab khayma nazar aaya, laashe ko rakh dete hain. Kehte hain banu hashim ke je bacche aake apne bhai ke laash ko le jao, is baat se abhi ye laashan nahi uthta. Matam Hussain.